Thank you for downloading this Simon & Schuster ebook. Get a free ebook when you join our mailing list. Plus, get updates on new releases, deals, recommended reads, and more from Simon & Schuster. Click below to sign up and see terms and conditions. Click here to sign up already a subscriber. Provide your email again so we can register this ebook and send you more of what you like to read. You will continue to receive exclusive offers in your inbox. To Annie and Moshe introduction. What didn't happen? I've spent part of nearly every day since November 8, 2016, wrestling with a single question, writes Hillary Clinton in What Happened. Why did I lose? 1. What Happened is an unusual book. Published mere months after the 2016 presidential election, it is the defeated candidate's eor to understand how she fell short. At its core is the belief that something extraordinary and bizarre occurred in 2016, an outcome beyond the boundaries of the normal give and take of American politics, an aberration that must be explained. If Mitt Romney had won in 2012, Barack Obama would not have released a book entitled What the Hell? So, too, if John Kerry had swept to victory in 2004, George W. Bush would not be joined by millions in puzzling over the breach. In American politics, loss is part of life. Thrumming through Clinton's book and in the anguished hood of post-election commentary from liberals and never-Trumpers is the belief that 2016 was not like 2012 or 2004. Reality had ruptured. We were owed answers. To be fair, something strange had happened. Donald Trump won the election. There was a Maya Angelou quote that ricocheted across social media during the 2016 election, "When someone shows you who they are, believe them." Trump showed us who he was gleefully, constantly. He mocked John McCain for being captured in Vietnam and suggested Ted Cruz's father had helped assassinate JFK. He bragged about the size of his penis and mused that his whole life had been motivated by greed. He made no mystery of his bigotry or sexism. He called himself a genius while retweeting conspiracy theories in caps lock. Even Trump's team didn't believe he was going to win. Plans were afoot for him to start a television channel in the aftermath of his loss. And then came election night. He won the Electoral College even though 61% of voters, in election day exit polls, said he was unqualified to hold the presidency, even though most voters had a higher opinion of Clinton and believed Trump lacked the temperament for the OCE he sought. 2. The U.S. presidency is a sacred trust, its occupant the wielder of unimaginable destructive power, and here, we had handed it to a human hurricane. And we had done so knowingly, purposefully. It is this errant that motivates what happened. Clinton is trying to explain how Trump's victory came to pass. She seeks exoneration, but the confusion is real. She is helped in this by the peculiar nature of Trump's triumph. He lost the popular vote by millions of ballots, and his Electoral College margin rested on a sliver of the population. As Clinton writes, if just 40,000 people across Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania had changed their minds, she would have won. With a margin that narrow, more than 136 million votes were cast in total. Anything can explain the results. And that is where Clinton focuses her efforts, proving, convincingly, that everything from James Comey's letter to Russia's interference to deep-seated sexism could have, and probably did, account for the thin margin by which she lost. But such analyses pose the easy question rather than the hard one. Rather than asking how Trump won, we should be asking how Trump was close enough to win. How did a candidate like Trump, a candidate who radiated contempt for the party he represented and unfitness for the job he sought, get within a few thousand votes of the presidency in the RST place? This was a question I posed in mid-2017 to Larry Bartles, a political scientist at Vanderbilt University. Over years of political reporting, I had come to value Bartles's unsentimental analysis of American politics. Speaking to him has the harrowing quality of feeding questions into a computer that doesn't care if you like the results. And as I poured out my theories of the election, he stared back with bemusement. After I had worn myself out, he replied in a way that has tormented me since, "What if nothing unusual happened at all?" The premise of my questioning, Bartles calmly explained, was that the 2016 election was weird. And he was right, that was my premise. I had seen things happen in American politics that I would have rejected as laughable if they'd been on an episode of House of Cards and too dark to be funny if they'd been on Veep. And this wasn't a hysterical reaction unique to my anxious mind. Mine was a gentle version of the conventional wisdom. In The New Yorker, for instance, Adam Gonick argued that Trump's victory owed support for the hypothesis that we are living in a computer simulation and that something has recently gone haywire within it. Three, but Bartels had been looking at the data and he disagreed. The 2016 election didn't look like a glitch, he said. It looked, for the most part, like every other election we've had recently. The simulation was, if anything, too stable. Like we had unleashed tornadoes and meteors on our virtual city and only a few windows had shattered. It was the normalcy that was unnerving. Take gender. Clinton was the RST female candidate nominated by a major party for president. Trump was a male ID in a suit, bragging about grabbing women by the pussy and oh-handedly rating the sexual desirability of those who challenged him. This was, then, an election designed to split us more deeply by gender than any in recent history. But turn to the exit polls. In 2004, the Republican candidate for president won 55% of men. In 2008, he won 48% of men. In 2012, 52%. And in 2016? Trump won 52% of men, precisely matching Romney's performance. The story is similar among women. In 2004, the Republican won 48% of female voters. In 2008, he won 43%, in 2012, 44%. And in 2016? 41%. Lower, but only 2 percentage points beneath John McCain in 2008. No earthquake. Let's look at it a different way. This was the white nationalism election, when the alt-right came into its own, when Trump promised to sweep in after the RST black president in American history and put America back the way it was, to build a wall and make America great again. And yet, in 2004, the GOP candidate won 58% of white voters. In 2008, he won 55% of white voters. In 2012, he won 59% of white voters. Fast forward to 2016, 57%. Of course, there was no group Trump assailed more regularly than Hispanic immigrants. He launched his campaign by descending a golden escalator and proclaiming, "When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people." In 2004, the Republican candidate won 44% of Hispanic voters. In 2008, he won 31%. In 2012, 27%. And in 2016, 28%. After the GOP's 2004 victory, the Republican Party's dominance was widely ascribed to Bush's deep, authentic bond with white, born-again Christians, of whom 78% pulled the lever for his re-election. In 2008, the GOP candidate won 74% of these voters. In 2012, it was back up to 78%. But Trump was different. He was a morally louche adulterer who ant his wealth, and when asked, on the campaign trail, if he ever turned to God for forgiveness, he said, "I am not sure I have." So how did he do among white, born-again voters? He won 80%. Perhaps this is best viewed through the lens of partisanship. In 2016, Republicans nominated a thrice-married billionaire who had been a Democrat mere years before, who was dismissed in a National Review cover story as a threat to conservatism for who had few ties to the Republican Party and viewed its previous standard-bearers with contempt, who spoke openly about his action for Social Security, Medicare, and Planned Parenthood. In 2004, the Republican candidate won 93% of self-identified Republicans. In 2008, he won 90%. In 2012, he won 93%. In 2016, he won 88%. A drop, to be sure, but nothing calamitous. The popular vote margin is also telling. In 2004, the Republican candidate won by 3 million votes. In 2008, the Democrat won by more than 9 million votes. In 2012, the Democrat won by almost 5 million votes. And in 2016, the Democrat again won by almost 3 million votes. The intervention of the Electoral College overturned this margin, of course, but if you're just looking to the winds of popular support, 2016 isn't an obvious aberration. Here, then, is Bartels's point. If you'd been given a printout of voter data from the past few elections and been asked to identify which campaign was the bizarre one, the one that would rock American politics and lead to book after book trying to explain the outcome, would you be able to do so? The results in 2016 mostly looked like 2012 and 2008 and 2004, even though the winning candidate is one of the most bizarre guys ever to crash into American politics. What's surprising about the 2016 election results isn't what happened. It's what didn't happen. Trump didn't lose by 30 points or win by 20 points. Most people who voted chose the same party in 2016 that they'd chosen in 2012. That isn't to say there was nothing at all distinct or worthy of study. Crucially, white voters without college education swung sharply toward Trump, and their overrepresentation in electorally key states won him the election. I5 But the campaign, by the numbers, was mostly a typical contest between a Republican and a Democrat. The fact that voters ultimately treated Trump as if he were just another Republican speaks to the enormous weight party polarization now exerts on our politics, a weight so heavy that it can take an election as bizarre as 2016 and jam the result into the same grooves as Romney's contest with Obama or Bush's race against Kerry. We are so locked into our political identities that there is virtually no candidate, no information, no condition, that can force us to change our minds. We will justify almost anything or anyone so long as it helps our side, and the result is a politics devoid of guardrails, standards, persuasion, or accountability. And yet, we have not changed so much, have we? We still coach Little League and care for our parents. We cry at romantic comedies and mow our lawns, we laugh at our eccentricities and apologize for harsh words, we want to be loved and wish for a better world. That is not to absolve us of responsibility for our politics, but to trace a lament oft heard when we step away from politics, aren't we better than this? I think we are, or we can be. But toxic systems compromise good individuals with ease. They do so not by demanding we betray our values but by enlisting our values such that we betray each other. What is rational and even moral for us to do individually becomes destructive when done collectively. How American politics became a toxic system, why we participate in it, and what it means for our future is the subject of this book. Thinking in Systems. Let me be clear from the beginning, this is not a book about people. This is a book about systems. The story of American politics is typically told through the stories of individual political actors. We focus on their genius, their hubris, their decency, their deceit. We take you inside their feuds, their thoughts, the bones mows they deliver in private meetings and the agonies they quietly conduct to friends. We locate the hinge moments of history in the decisions they make. And, in doing so, we suggest they could have made other decisions, or that other people, in their place, would have made different decisions. This assumption has the grace of truth, but not as much truth as we think, not as much truth as the breathless insider accounts of White House meetings and campaign machinations would have us believe. As a journalist, I have studied American politics for the better part of 20 years. I have tried to understand it from the perspective of politicians, activists, political scientists, donors, voters, non-voters, STAERS, pundits, anyone who is affected by it or who is acting it. In the course of that reporting, I have come across political actors who strike me as cynics, fools, and villains. They are the broken parts of American politics, and it is tempting to blame our problems on their low morals or poor judgment. Indeed, we do exactly that in election years, when our dissatisfaction with the way the system is working leads us to re some of the people and hire other people, and then a few years later, we end the system still broken, and we do it again and again and again. As I have watched one election's heroes turn into the next election's scoundrels, as I have listened to rational people give me thoughtful reasons for doing ridiculous things, I have lost faith in these stories. We collapse systemic problems into personalized narratives, and when we do, we cloud our understanding of American politics and confuse our theories of repair. We try to X the system by changing the people who run it, only to end that they become part of the system, too. I knew Republicans who, though they voted for McCain, were hopeful about Obama only to discover he was just another Democrat. I knew Democrats who were glad Trump was going to remake the Republican Party along populist lines, only to be bitterly disappointed when he signed on to almost everything the congressional GOP wanted. Every few years, a new crop of politicians emerges promising to put country over party, to govern on behalf of the people rather than the powerful, to listen to the better angels of our nature rather than the howling of our factions. And then the clock ticks forward, the insurgents become the establishment, public disillusionment sets in, the electorate swings a bit to the other side, and we start again. This cycle is a tributary feeding into the country's political rage. It is maddening to keep trying to X a problem that only seems to get worse. My intention in this book is to zoom out from the individuals to better see interlocking systems that surround them. I will use specific politicians as examples, but only insofar as they are marionettes of broader forces. What I seek isn't a story but a blueprint, a map to the machine that shapes political decisions. This is a mode of analysis common to other elds but often ignored in my own. In his book Drift into Failure, From Hunting Broken Components to Understanding Complex Systems, Sydney Decker, founder of the Safety Science Innovation Lab at Australia's GTH University, distinguishes between two different ways of diagnosing why a system is failing. The most traditional, and the most common, approach is we see a problem, hunt for the broken part, and try to replace it. Decker studies accidents, so his examples are plane crashes and oil spills, where catastrophe is followed by an obsessive search for the nut that proved defective, the maintenance check that got missed, the wing AP that cracked in the cold. But much political analysis follows this model, too. American politics is broken, and the problem is money, political correctness, social media, political consultants, or Mitch McConnell. Fix the part, these analyses promise, and you X the whole. The reality, Decker says, is that complex systems often fail the public even as they're succeeding by their own logic. If you discover the screw that failed or the maintenance shift that was missed, you might think you've found the broken part. But if you miss the way the stock market was rewarding the company for cutting costs on maintenance, you've missed the cause of the crisis, and failed to prevent its recurrence. Systems thinking, he writes, is about understanding how accidents can happen when no parts are broken, or no parts are seen as broken. Six, that may not sound like American politics to you. It is, at this point, cliché to call it broken. But that is our mistake. The American political system, which includes everyone from voters to journalists to the president, is full of rational actors making rational decisions given the incentives they face. We are a collection of functional parts whose eorts combine into a dysfunctional whole. That the worst actors are so often draped in success doesn't prove the system is broken, it proves that they understand the ways in which it truly works. That is knowledge the rest of us need, if we are to change it. This quote from Decker describes much of what I have seen and much of how I intend to approach this investigation. In Stories of Drift into Failure, organizations fail precisely because they are doing well on a narrow range of performance criteria, that is the ones that they get rewarded on in their current political or economic or commercial configuration. In the Drift into Failure, accidents can happen without anything breaking, without anybody erring, without anybody violating the rules they consider relevant. I am sensitive to these incentives because I live them. I am not outside the system looking in but inside the system looking out. I am a journalist, a pundit, and a co-founder of Vox, the explanatory news publication. I am a member of the political media, and I know that for all that we try to hide it, we are political actors, and the decisions we make are both cause and consequences of the broader forces that surround us. I am a voter, a news junkie, and a liberal. I am motivated in part by the radicalizing realization that I am often carrying out the biddings of a system I dislike, by the frustration that overcomes me when I realize I am acting more like American politics than like myself. And I am not alone. I spend my days interviewing participants in the American political system, smart people doing their best, puzzling over the vast dysfunction that surrounds them and explaining away their own contributions to it. My background is in policy reporting, and over years of covering different issues, I have seen the same pattern play out again and again. Whatever the problem, it begins with meetings in which experts of all different perspectives sit together on panels and discuss the many ways it can be solved. At this point, there is always a large zone of agreement, a belief that a compromise can be reached that will leave everyone better off compared to the status quo. But as the process wears on, as the politicians focus their attention and the media focuses its coverage, agreement dissolves. What once struck participants as reasonable compromises become unreasonable demands. What was once a positive-sum negotiation becomes a zero-sum war. And everyone involved believes every decision they made along the way was reasonable. Usually, from their perspective, they are right. As such, I have found that American politics is best understood by braiding two forms of knowledge that are often left separate: the direct, on-the-ground insights shared by politicians, activists, government officials, and other subjects of my reporting, and the more systemic analyses conducted by political scientists, sociologists, historians, and others with the time, methods, and expertise to study American politics at scale. On their own, political actors often ignore the incentives shaping their decisions, and academic researchers miss the human motivations that drive political decision-making. Together, however, they shine bright light on how and why American politics works the way it does. There is much awry in American politics, and I won't, in this book, attempt to catalog all of it. But I've come to believe the master story, the one that drives almost all divides and most fundamentally shapes the behavior of participants, is the logic of polarization. That logic, put simply, is this: to appeal to a more polarized public, political institutions and political actors behave in more polarized ways. As political institutions and actors become more polarized, they further polarize the public. This sets off a feedback cycle. To appeal to a yet more polarized public, institutions must polarize further. When faced with yet more polarized institutions, the public polarizes further, and so on. Understanding that we exist in relationship with our political institutions, that they are changed by us and we are changed by them, is the key to this story. We don't just use politics for our own ends. Politics uses us for its own ends. Rescuing identity politics. There are many different types of polarization possible, and I'll discuss some of them later in the book. But the locus of polarization I will focus on is political identity. And that requires saying a few words about a term that should be very useful in American politics but that has become almost useless: identity politics. A core argument of this book is that everyone engaged in American politics is engaged in identity politics. This is not an insult, and it's not controversial. We form and fold identities constantly, naturally. Identity is present in politics in the way gravity, evolution, or cognition is present in politics. That is to say, it is omnipresent in politics, because it is omnipresent in us. There is no way to read the literature on how humans form and protect their personal and group identities, literature I will survey in this book, and believe any of us is immune. It runs so deep in our psyches, is activated so easily by even weak cues and distant threats, that it is impossible to speak seriously about how we engage with one another without discussing how our identities shape that engagement. Unfortunately, the term identity politics has been weaponized. It is most often used by speakers to describe politics as practiced by members of historically marginalized groups. If you're black and you're worried about police brutality, that's identity politics. If you're a woman and you're worried about the male-female pay gap, that's identity politics. But if you're a rural gun owner decrying universal background checks as tyranny, or a billionaire CEO complaining that high tax rates demonize success, or a Christian insisting on nativity scenes in public squares, well, that's just good, old-fashioned politics. With a quick sleight of hand, identity becomes something that only marginalized groups have. The term identity politics, in this usage, obscures rather than illuminates. It's used to diminish and discredit the concerns of weaker groups by making them look like self-interested, special pleading in order to clear the agenda for the concerns of stronger groups, which are framed as more rational, proper topics for political debate. But in wielding identity as a blade, we have lost it as a lens, blinding ourselves in a bid for political advantage. We are left searching in vain for what we refuse to allow ourselves to see. 27 All politics is enhanced by identity. Those identities are most powerful when they are so pervasive as to be either invisible or uncontroversial. American is an identity. So, too, is Christian. When politicians, including the irreligious, end speeches with "God bless America," it is not because they are making an appeal to a higher power, but because they are making an appeal to our bedrock identities. If you don't believe me, ask yourself why there are so few open atheists or even agnostics in national politics. This does not mean that politics is an equation solved by locating identity. Identity shapes our worldview, but it does not mechanistically decide it. And while we often speak of identity as a singular, it is always a dizzying plural. We have countless identities, some of them in active conflict with each other, others lying dormant until activated by threat or fortune. Much that happens in political campaigns is best understood as a struggle over which identities voters will inhabit come election day. Will they feel like workers exploited by their bosses, or heartlanders dismissed by coastal elites? Will they vote as patriotic traditionalists upended by NFL players who kneel during the national anthem, or as parents worried about the climate their children will inhabit? What we are often ting over in American politics is group identity and status ghts that express themselves in debates over policy and power but cannot be truly reconciled by either. Health policy is positive sum, but identity conflict is zero sum. Identity, of course, is nothing new. So how can it explain the changes in our politics? The answer is that our political identities are changing and strengthening. The most powerful identities in modern politics are our political identities, which have come, in recent decades, to encompass and amplify a range of other central identities as well. Over the past FTY years, our partisan identities have merged with our racial, religious, geographic, ideological, and cultural identities. Those merged identities have attained a weight that is breaking our institutions and tearing at the bonds that hold this country together. This is the form of identity politics most prevalent in our country, and most in need of interrogation. The RST part of this book will tell the story of how and why American politics polarized around identity in the 20th century and what that polarization did to the way we see the world and each other. The second half of the book is about the feedback loops between polarized political identities and polarized political institutions that are driving our political system toward crisis. What I am trying to develop here isn't so much an answer for the problems of American politics as a framework for understanding them. If I've done my job well, this book will offer a model that helps make sense of an era in American politics that can seem senseless. Let's get started. In an analysis published on Vox, political scientist and statistician Andrew Gelman and business and strategy professor Pierre-Antoine Krempe ended that per voter, whites have 16% more power than blacks once the electoral college is taken into consideration, 28% more power than Latinos, and 57% more power than those who fall into the other category. 2. In her book How We Get Free, Kianga Yomita-Taylor traces the RST usage of the term identity politics to the Combahee River Collective's 1977 statement of principles, which read, "This focusing upon our own oppression is embodied in the concept of identity politics. We believe that the most profound and potentially most radical politics come directly out of our own identity, as opposed to working to end somebody else's oppression. In the case of black women, this is a particularly repugnant, dangerous, threatening, and therefore revolutionary concept, because it is obvious from looking at all the political movements that have preceded us that anyone is more worthy of liberation than ourselves. We reject pedestals, queenhood, and walking 10 paces behind. To be recognized as human, levelly human, is enough. As Barbara Smith, one of the founding members of the collective, tells Taylor, "What we were saying is that we have a right as people who are not just female, who are not solely black, who are not just lesbians, who are not just working class, or workers, that we are people who embody all of these identities, and we have a right to build and deem political theory and practice based upon that reality." Chapter 1: How Democrats Became Liberals and Republicans Became Conservatives. The RST thing I need to do is convince you something has changed. American politics OERS, the comforting illusion of stability. The Democratic and Republican parties have dominated elections since 1864, grappling for power and popularity the whole time. Scour American history and you will see Democrats and Republicans slandering each other, undermining each other, plotting against each other, even physically assaulting each other. I. It is easy to cast a quick glance backward and assume our present is a rough match for our past, that the complaints we have about politics today mirror the complaints past generations had of the politics of their day. But the Democratic and Republican parties of today are not like the Democratic and Republican parties of yesteryear. We are living through something genuinely new. Rewind to 1950. That was the year the American Political Science Association, APSA, Committee on Political Parties released a call to arms that sounds like satire to modern ears. Entitled Towards a More Responsible Two-Party System, the 98-page paper, co-authored by many of the country's most eminent political scientists and covered on the front page of the New York Times, pleads for a more polarized political system. It laments that the parties contain too much diversity of opinion and work together too easily, leaving voters confused about who to vote for and why. Unless the parties identify themselves with programs, the public is unable to make an intelligent choice between them, warned the authors. Too, it is difficult, watching the party line votes and contempt for compromise that denies Congress today, to read sentences like "the parties have done little to build up the kind of unity within the congressional party that is now so widely desired" and hear the logic behind them. Summarized today, the report can sound like a call for fewer puppies and more skin fungus. But as Colgate University political scientist Sam Rosenfeld argues in his book The Polarizers, Post-War Architects of Our Partisan Era, there were good reasons to worry about the muddle the parties had made of mid-century American politics. The activists and politicians who worked relentlessly, over years, to bring about the polarized political system we see today had good reasons for what they did. Appreciating the logic of the polarizers' argument, alongside the wreckage produced by their success, is a bracing antidote to both a golden view of the past and overly condensed prescriptions for the future. 2. To understand the political scientists' concerns, we need to understand the role political parties are supposed to play in a democracy. Consider the issues that you, as a citizen, are routinely asked to render a judgment on. Should we go to war in Iraq, or Syria, or Iran, or North Korea? Does it make sense to organize our healthcare system around private insurers brought to heel by regulations and an individual mandate? What is the proper term for a copyright? Should it last for a decade, 4 decades, 100 years, or until the sun burns out and dooms this fragile world? Should federal tax revenues equal 28% of GDP, 31% of GDP, or 39% of GDP over the next decade? What's the proper level of immigration each year, and how much of it should go to reuniting families and how much to tooling economic needs? Would breaching the debt ceiling really damage America's creditworthiness forevermore? None of us can amass sufficient expertise on such a range of topics. Political parties are shortcuts. The APSA report called them indispensable instruments of government, because they provide the electorate with a proper range of choice between alternatives of action. We may not know the precise right level for taxes, or whether it makes sense to create a no-fly zone over Syria, but we know whether we support the Democratic, Republican, Green, or Libertarian Party. The act of choosing a party is the act of choosing whom we trust to transform our values into precise policy judgments across the vast range of issues that confront the country. For the great majority of Americans, the authors write, the most valuable opportunity to enhance the course of public affairs is the choice they are able to make between the parties in the principal elections. The problem in 1950 was that the nation's two major political parties weren't honoring the intentions of their voters. A Minnesota Democrat pulling the lever for Hubert Humphrey, her party's liberal Senate candidate in 1954, was also voting for a Senate majority that would include Strom Thurmond, the South Carolina senator who was among the chamber's most conservative members. Rather than o-erring a choice, the parties were o-erring a mush. .3 This was the problem as the members of APSA saw it. The state parties were organizing politics around lines the national parties were erasing. The national and state party organizations are largely independent of one another, each operating within its own sphere, without appreciable common approach to problems of party policy and strategy, complained the authors. The U.S. Congress included Democrats more conservative than many Republicans and Republicans as liberal as the most left-leaning Democrats. They were robbing voters of their most valuable opportunity to enhance the course of public affairs. Senator William Borah, an Idaho Republican, put it piquantly in 1923. Any man who can carry a Republican primary is a Republican, he said. He might believe in free trade, in unconditional membership in the League of Nations, in states' rights, and in every policy that the Democratic Party ever advocated, yet, if he carried his Republican primary, he would be a Republican. 3. Being a Republican did not mean being a conservative. It meant being a Republican. Party affiliation was a tautology for itself, not a rich sinecure of principles and perspective. In 1950, Thomas Dewey, the former governor of New York and the GOP's 1944 nominee for president, freely admitted that if the measure of a real political party was a uni-ed organization with a national viewpoint on major issues, neither the Republican nor Democratic Party quali-ed. Dewey thought this a great strength, since no single religion or color or race or economic interest is con-ed to one or the other of our parties. Each party is to some extent a reaction of the other. This is perhaps part of the secret of our enormous power, that a change from one party to the other has usually involved a continuity of action and policy of the nation as a whole on most fundamentals. He allowed that there were those who rail at both parties, saying they represent nothing but a choice between Tweedledee and Tweedledum. If the critics had their way, he said, they then would have everything very neatly arranged, indeed. The Democratic Party would be the liberal to radical party. The Republican Party would be the conservative to reactionary party. 4. Narrator, they would have their way. In 1959, then Vice President Richard Nixon, who would go on, as president, to create the Environmental Protection Agency, consider a basic minimum income, and propose a national health care plan more ambitious than Obamacare, spoke with derision of those who sought to cleave the parties by their beliefs. It would be a great tragedy if we had our two major political parties divide on what we would call a conservative-liberal line, he said. The strength of the American political system is we have avoided generally violent swings in administrations from one extreme to the other. And the reason we have avoided that is that in both parties there has been room for a broad spectrum of opinion. 5. In this, if in little else, Nixon was joined by Robert F. Kennedy. The journalist Godfrey Hodgson recounts a conversation where Kennedy warned that the country was already split vertically, between sections, races, and ethnic groups, so it would be dangerous to split it horizontally, too, between liberals and conservatives. 6. Politics, in this telling, was meant to calm our divisions, not represent them. In 1959, the Republican National Committee held an internal debate over whether the party should be driven by a distinct set of ideological values. At the inaugural meeting of the Committee on Program and Progress, which was tasked with designing the GOP agenda, the group invited the political scientist Robert Goldwin to make the case that it is neither possible nor desirable for a major political party to be guided by principles. Our modern cleavages give Goldwin's concerns a force that they would not have carried in 1959. With both parties including liberals and conservatives within their ranks, he said, those differences which would otherwise be the main campaign issues are settled by compromise within each party. He warned that our national unity would be weakened if the theoretical differences were sharpened. 7. This is a profound enough point worth dwelling on for a moment. When a division exists inside a party, it gets addressed through suppression or compromise. Parties don't want to ght among themselves. But when a division exists between the parties, it gets addressed through conict. Without the restraint of party unity, political disagreements escalate. An example here is healthcare. Democrats and Republicans spend billions of dollars in election ads emphasizing their disagreements on healthcare, because the debate motivates their supporters and, they hope, turns the public against their opponents. The upside of this is that important issues get aired and sometimes even resolved. The downside is that the divisions around them become deeper and angrier. This debate exploded into the open during Barry Goldwater's 1964 presidential announcement speech. The address is now remembered for Goldwater's promise to OER a choice, not an echo. Less well known, but perhaps more telling, is the rationale for his candidacy that comes a few paragraphs earlier. Goldwater says, with some disgust, "I have not heard from any announced Republican candidate a declaration of conscience or of political position that could possibly OER to the American people a clear choice in the next presidential election." This was Goldwater's promise: if Republicans nominated him, the election would not be an engagement of personalities. It will be an engagement of principles. Goldwater, of course, won the nomination and got destroyed by Lyndon Johnson. Goldwater's convention was a harshly factional affair, with conservative Republicans doing their damnedest to expel the moderate wing of the party. In its aftermath, George Romney, then the governor of Michigan and a leading light of moderate Republicanism, wrote a 12-page letter outlining his disagreements with Goldwater. "Dogmatic ideological parties tend to splinter the political and social fabric of a nation, lead to governmental crises and deadlocks, and stymie the compromises so often necessary to preserve freedom and achieve progress," he wrote, rather prophetically. 8. Decades later, his son, who had carried on his father's legacy as the popular moderate governor of Massachusetts, would win the Republican nomination for the presidency by recasting himself as severely conservative. Goldwater's electoral destruction entrenched the conventional wisdom of the age: ideologues lost elections. In his 1960 book Parties and Politics in America, Clinton Rossiter wrote, "There is and can be no real difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, because the unwritten laws of American politics demand that the parties overlap substantially in principle, policy, character, appeal, and purpose, or cease to be parties with any hope of winning a national election." 9. Better to be an echo than an also-ran. The muddling of the parties carried well into the modern era. Stanford University political scientist Morris Fiorina notes that when Gerald Ford ran against Jimmy Carter, only 54% of the electorate believed the Republican Party was more conservative than the Democratic Party. Almost 30% said there was no ideological difference at all between the two parties. 10. Imagine, in a world where the ideological difference between the Democratic and Republican parties was slim enough to confuse half the population, how much less force party identity must have carried. Actually, we don't have to imagine. We can see it. The power of negative partisanship. It used to be common for voters to split their tickets. Perhaps you preferred Democrat Lyndon Johnson for president but Republican George Romney for governor. And if you were a ticket splitter, and most of the people you knew were ticket splitters, it was hard to identify too deeply with either party. After all, you occasionally voted for both. In a striking analysis entitled "All Politics is National," Emory University political scientists Alan Abramovitz and Stephen Webster show how that behavior collapsed in the latter half of the 20th century and virtually disappeared across the millennium's dividing line. Looking at districts with contested House races, they found that between 1972 and 1980, the correlation between the Democratic share of the House vote and the Democratic share of the presidential vote was 0.54. Between 1982 and 1990, that rose to 0.65. By 2018, it had reached 0.97, 11 in 40 years. Support for the Democratic presidential candidate went from being a helpful, but far from reliable, predictor of support for a party's house candidate to being an almost perfect guide. Ticket splitting requires a baseline comfort with both political parties. Behind its demise is the evaporation of that comfort. Amid the battery of questions that surveyors ask Americans in every election lurks something called the feeling thermometer. The thermometer asks people to rate their feelings toward the two political parties on a scale of 1 to 100 degrees, where 1 is cold and negative and 100 is warm and positive. Since the 1980s, Republicans' feelings toward the Democratic Party and Democrats' feelings toward the Republican Party have dropped OACLI. In 1980, voters gave the opposite party a 45 on the thermometer, not as high as the 72 they gave their own party, but a pretty decent number all the same. After 1980, though, the numbers began dropping. By 1992, the opposing party was down to 40, by 1998, it had fallen to 38, in 2016, it was down to 29. Meanwhile, partisans' views toward their own parties fell from 72 in 1980 to 65 in 2016.12, but it wasn't just partisans. In his important paper Polarization and the Decline of the American Floating Voter, Michigan State University political scientist Corwin Smith found that between 2000 and 2004, self-proclaimed independents were more stable in which party they supported than self-proclaimed strong partisans were from 1972 to 1976.13. I want to say that again, today's independents vote more predictably for one party over the other than yesteryear's partisans. That's a remarkable fact. Here's what's strange, though, over this same period, the electorate was shrugging off its party allegiances. In 1964, about 80% of voters said they were either Republicans or Democrats. By 2012, that had dropped to 63%, the lowest percentage of party identity in the history of the American National Election Studies, notes Abramovitz and Webster, with the share of self-proclaimed independents rising sharply. On RST glance, these two trends contradict. How can the electorate become both more partisan in its voting behavior and more independent in its party membership? Shouldn't more consistent support for a party lead to a closer allegiance to that party? The key idea here is negative partisanship, partisan behavior driven not by positive feelings toward the party you support but negative feelings toward the party you oppose. If you've ever voted in an election feeling a bit bleh about the candidate you backed, but fearful of the troglodyte or socialist running against her, you've been a negative partisan. It turns out a lot of us have been negative partisans. A 2016 Pew poll found that self-described independents who tended to vote for one party or the other were driven more by negative motivations. Majorities of both Republican and Democratic-leaning independents said a major reason for their lean was the other party's policies were bad for the country. By contrast, only a third of each group said they were driven by support for the policies of the party they were voting for. 14. So here, then, is the last FTY years of American politics summarized. We became more consistent in the party we vote for not because we came to like our party more, indeed, we've come to like the parties we vote for less, but because we came to dislike the opposing party more. Even as hope and change sputter, fear and loathing proceed. The question is why all this happened. What changed in American politics such that voters became so reliably partisan? The rational partisan is a pejorative in American life. The statement Americans have become much more partisan since 1972 isn't neutral. It reads as an indictment. An insult. Partisanship is bad. It's unthinking, angry, even un-American. Partisans are the ones George Washington warned us of in his farewell address. They put, in the place of the delegated will of the nation, the will of a party, often a small but artful and enterprising minority of the community, and, according to the alternate triumphs of deranged parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than the organ of consistent and wholesome plans digested by common councils and modi-ed by mutual interests. Nasty stew. Washington's address precursed much of what was to come in American politics. As the Princeton historian Sean Willance wrote in The New Republic, it was a highly partisan appeal delivered as an attack on partisanship and on the low demagogues who fomented it. 15. Washington delivered the speech, co-written by Alexander Hamilton, as America was splitting into a two-party system, the Federalists, led by John Adams and Hamilton, and the Democratic Republicans, led by Thomas J. E. Ayerson and James Madison. Washington was, in EECT, a Federalist, and in warning against the development of factions, he was warning against those who had arisen to challenge his chosen successors. As Willens wrote, Washington's address never explicitly mentioned J. E. Ayerson or his supporters, but its unvarnished attack on organized political opposition was plainly directed against them. If Washington's intervention was partisan, his instincts were thoroughly American. This has been the balance Americans have struck ever since, a system denied by political parties whose existence we decry. We mistrust ideologues and partisans. We venerate centrists, moderates, independents. In a telling experiment, Samara Clara and Yana Krupnikov cued subjects to think about political disagreements and then handed them photographs of strangers, some of whom were identified as independents and others of whom were said to be partisans. The independents were rated as more attractive, even when, by objective standards, the partisans were actually more attractive. In another test of the theory, Clark and Krupnikov found that Americans are nearly 60% more likely to call themselves independents when they're told they need to make a good impression on a stranger. 16. Being independent isn't about whom you vote for. It's about your personal brand. Our appreciation of independence reacts our denial of the substance of partisanship. We want to wish away the depths of our disagreements, and it is convenient to blame them instead on the maneuverings of misguided partisans. But partisans aren't bad people perverting the political system through irrationality and self-interest. They're normal people, you and me, reacting the deep deerrances that deny political systems the world over. And the more deerrant the parties are, the more rational partisanship becomes. What has happened to American politics in recent decades is that the parties have become visibly, undeniably more deerrant, and the country has rationally become more partisan in response. Since 1994, the Pew Research Center has conducted massive surveys of American political opinion, and the endings are stark. 17. In 1994, for instance, 39% of Democrats and 26% of Republicans said discrimination was the main reason many black people couldn't get ahead in society. By 2017, the number of Democrats who agreed with that statement had jumped to 64%, while the number of Republicans who agreed with it was just 14%. Similarly, in 1994, 32% of Democrats and 30% of Republicans agreed that immigrants strengthened the country. By 2017, that had jumped to 84% of Democrats but only 42% of Republicans. In 1994, 63% of Republicans and 44% of Democrats agreed that poor people had it easy because they could get government help without doing anything in return. By 2017, the number of Republicans who agreed with that statement had risen slightly, to 65%. But the number of Democrats who agreed with it had tumbled to 18%. The bottom line is this, concludes the report, across 10 measures that Pew Research Center has tracked on the same surveys since 1994, the average partisan gap has increased from 15 percentage points to 36.18. It's worth being clear about what this means. If you're a Democrat, the Republican Party of 2017 poses a much sharper threat to your vision of a good society than the Republican Party of 1994 did. It includes fewer people who agree with you, and it has united around an agenda much further away from yours. The same is true, of course, for Republicans peering at the modern Democratic Party. This isn't just a quirky ending of the pollsters. It's visible in even the most cursory look at the party's governing agendas. Indeed, it's arguably been caused by the sharp divergence in the party's agendas. 4. Both Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush signed legislation raising taxes, for instance. That would be unthinkable in today's Republican Party, where almost every elected OCHAL has signed a pledge promising to never raise taxes under any circumstances. Bush also signed the Americans with Disabilities Act into law and oversaw a cap-and-trade program to reduce the pollutants behind acid rain. Reagan, for his part, signed an immigration reform bill that today's Democrats venerate and today's Republicans denounce. I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and who have lived here even though some time back they may have entered illegally, 19 Reagan said. Yes, Reagan said that. President Bill Clinton, meanwhile, launched his administration with a budget designed to reduce the deficit and an all-out effort to pass the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. He famously ran against the left wing of his own party, yinging back to Arkansas to preside over the execution of a brain-damaged inmate and publicly denouncing the rapper Sister Souljah. He worked with congressional Republicans to slash welfare and balance the federal budget. During his second term, he proudly declared that the era of big government is over. Healthcare ORS an even starker example. In 1965, a Democratic president created a massive, single-payer healthcare system for the nation's elderly. But as liberal as Medicare was in both conception and execution, it received 70 Republican votes in the House as well as 13 Republican votes in the Senate. Obamacare, by contrast, was modeled on Mitt Romney's reforms in Massachusetts and built atop many Republican ideas, v. it relied on private insurers for the bulk of its coverage expansion and ended up sacrificing its public option. But as compromised as Obamacare was in design, and as desperate as the Obama administration was for bipartisan support, and believe me, I covered that GHT, they would have traded almost anything for Republican backing. The legislation didn't receive a single Republican vote in either the House or the Senate. It's easy to see how a liberal voter in 1965 might think Republicans were open to something like Medicare. Many Republicans really were open to something like Medicare. Today, however, no voter would be confused as to which party supports the government doing more to guarantee health insurance. The choice between the two parties is much, much clearer. Or take abortion. In 1982, Senator Joe Biden voted for a constitutional amendment that would let states overturn Roe v. Wade. He called it, at the time, the single most difficult vote I've cast as a U.S. Senator. Biden, a practicing Catholic, explained his decision in terms of his upbringing. I'm probably a victim, or a product, however you want to phrase it, of my background. But as my Vox colleague Anna North has shown, he was also a product of his political moment. 20 President Gerald Ford had opposed Roe, but his vice president, Nelson Rockefeller, had repealed abortion restrictions as governor of New York. The 1976 Republican platform called abortion one of the most difficult and controversial questions of our time. 21 It went on to recognize the split inside the Republican Party, saying, "There are those in our party who favor complete support for the Supreme Court decision which permits abortion on demand. There are others who share sincere convictions that the Supreme Court's decision must be changed by a constitutional amendment prohibiting all abortions." In Congress, Republicans and Democrats voted against abortion in similar numbers. In surveys, Democrats and Republicans were equally likely to say it should be legal in all circumstances as illegal in all cases. Today, Biden says of the conservative effort to overturn Roe, "It's wrong. It's pernicious. And we have to stop it." 22 Similarly, modern Republican platforms mince no words on the issue. "We assert the sanctity of human life and arm that the unborn child has a fundamental right to life which cannot be infringed," read the GOP's 2016 platform. Far from recognizing Republicans who support unfettered access to abortion, it assails Democrats for that position. Democrats' almost limitless support for abortion, and their strident opposition to even the most basic restrictions on abortion, put them dramatically out of step with the American people, it says. Like on health care, it's easy to see how a pro-choice voter could have found a home in the Republican Party of the 1970s, just as it's easy to see how a pro-life voter could have found space among the Democrats. Today, however, there is no room for confusion. Democrats support Roe. Republicans oppose it. You can know almost nothing about politics and know that. This helps explain a particularly striking ending of Smith's. One of the questions the American National Election Survey asks is whether voters felt like they really understood the differences between the two parties. Looking at responses to that question over time, Schmidt found that the voters were becoming much more aware of how the two parties de-aired. The change was so sharp, he wrote, that independent and inattentive voters exhibit an awareness of candidate de-errances across more political issues than strong partisan or politically attentive